you very much.
Now, I just came back. I was in Maui. I know. It's a dirty job. Somebody has to do it. I got elected. I don't mind. I'll do it. I got to stay for 2 months. I know. Anyway, I went there about this time last year, and I decided to write something like I'd never written before. I wrote a novel. This novel takes place on another planet. See what you think of this. This is a Voyager who winds up on this planet, Uranus, and finds out that he's on a planet that is exactly like Earth. It's a duplicate of Earth. Duplicate planet. Everything is the same. Okay? Everything's the same. Except that the people he notices as he checks into a Holiday Inn, you know, they have those little brown kind of shampoo bottles, the miniature ones, you know, that Sassoon puts out. Checks out. Everything's the same. But he notices that the people are different. And the only difference, it turns out, as he discovers this, is that the people on Uranus are neurotic by their reality. They have to be. They can't help it. It's the way things are. Because the first encounter is with this woman named Icus, who gives the anxiety attack report right after the weather. It turns out that on Uranus, anxiety really attacks. Right? So you have to be on guard for it all the time. You got to buy your Valium and get it ready in case an unexpected attack of anxiety comes over the mountain. So you can't figure this out. Starts talking to this person. Finds out that, you see, people on Earth, as he is talking to this woman, Icus, who is the only character in the book, talks to her about, like, people have anxiety attacks on Earth, too. And she can't, of course, you know, anxiety. But anxiety doesn't really attack, and she can't quite understand that, you see. So it's like when you begin to look at the difference between Uranus and Earth, you find that people are guilty on Uranus too. But guilt serves a purpose. Because if you feel guilty long enough on Uranus, you get to go into rewind. You go backwards, you get to do it over. Oh, yeah, it's great. It's great. Makes a lot of sense. See, then you'll hear people on Uranus saying, you know, you should have done it this way. If only you would have listened to me. And that makes sense there, because if you say you should have, you would have, you could have enough, you get to go back, do it over, and fix it. I didn't like the way I talked to my mother. I shouldn't have talked to her that way. That's right. You shouldn't have talked to her that way. Backwards, do it over. Mom, yeah, you know, you're really a nice lady. And get to do it over. There's no guilt serves a purpose. Okay? It's a great idea. Rewind would be great, wouldn't it? Because you hear people talking like we have rewind all the time. Oh, yeah. Sure. You hear it everywhere. I went up to give a speech up in Minnesota. Arrived there. The guy that picked me up at the airport, I said, look, these leaves. I haven't seen leaves changing in a long time. This is really beautiful. I said, can you just go a little slow? I'd like to see these. I live down in Florida where, you know. He said, Doc, he said, that's nothing. You should have been here last week. I said, what? He said, you should have been here last week. I said, last week I was in Florida. He said, yeah, but you should have been here. It was really beautiful. I said, you should have been here last week, this week. You can't do that. Can't do that on Earth. Just can't. You try it. You get out there and should have been here last week, this week. You can't do that. And Uranus, you can do that. You can't do that here. I don't want to be told what I should have done. You know, when your kids come home at 5 and they were supposed to have called at 3, and you tell them, you should have called at 3, they know they're talking to a banana. They know that. They can't say anything, but they know. And you hear people talking.
Wait a second. Close the doors here. Close the doors. Don't let anybody out. I want to tell you people something. Do you know that if every one of you in 1916, if you'd have bought 5 shares Coca-Cola, 5 shares Coca-Cola, you'd be millionaires today. Millionaires. I know some of you weren't alive in 1960. But you could have been. And if you would have been, and you would have bought those 5 shares, well, you wouldn't have any problems today. You hear this kind of talk all the time. Now, on Uranus, people there have phobias just like we have. You see, on Uranus, you'll hear people saying, whew, God, those elevators really scare me. Interesting thing is that elevators on Earth don't scare anybody. Yet people say it all the time. The elevator really scares me, really frightens me. On Uranus, they're programmed to scare, right? You get in and it goes, holy, what was that? That elevator really scared me. Not on Earth. It doesn't work that way. Yeah. I heard somebody on Uranus talking about gave his wife a complex.
One of my very favorite stories was from a woman, a beautiful woman, who was 39 years old and in therapy with me. And she said something to me one day in the course of a counseling session. She said, my husband gave me a complex. Almost like what I'd like to have is a complex for my wife. In this case, he needed 2 because she said he gave me a complex about my breasts and about my body. He gave me a complex. And I'll have 2 of those. If you gift wrap them, please. And on Mother's Day, it's you open them up and say, oh, look, a complex. Well, I'll put 1 right over here and 1 right over here. And people say, what happened to you? Oh, my husband gave me a complex about that's why I am the way I am. And he would say things to her like, she would say, he thinks I'm stupid. I said, well, knowing him as I did, that doesn't surprise me that he would say that. Did it ever occur to you that today he thinks you're stupid? And you are, obviously, because you're all upset about it. You must believe him. Did it ever occur to you that tomorrow he's going to come home and say, yesterday, dear, you were stupid. Today, you're a car. Why not? He could do anything knowing this guy. I said, would you be a car if he came home and said you were a car? He said, well, no, don't be. I said, wait a second. What if he said, okay, get down on all fours. I got a funnel with me. And put a funnel in your ear and started pouring gasoline into you. Would you be a car then? She said, of course not. I'm not a car. I said, why are you stupid? She was the kind of person who would go to a party and someone would say, hey, stupid, and she would turn around. I didn't know they knew I was coming to this party. Right away looking. I mean, that's really what paranoia is. You see, people are always talking about you all the time. It's just a question of, what do you do with it? A fully functioning person walks down the street and somebody looks at him and shh, 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 shh. That person says, of course they're talking about me. The only person around here worth being talked about. Probably got a lot of nice things to say about me. The neurotic says, oh my God, what are they saying about me? How could they be laughing about that? That's not, you know, and they get themselves all worked up. That's what paranoia is. The best definition I ever heard of it was something that Murray Banks told me. He said a woman was at the racetrack. And she walked up to somebody, she said, excuse me, do you have a safety pin, sir? And he said, no, I'm sorry, I don't. He walked up to somebody else, she got really nervous. Excuse me, do you have a safety pin over here? No, I don't have one, I'm sorry. Suddenly over the loudspeaker, she heard at the racetrack, they're off! And she fainted, okay? That's paranoia. Back to Uranus. If you believe that you can give somebody else a complex, or somebody else can give you a complex, you're in the wrong planet. Only on Uranus can you go in and order those things. And worry on Uranus is one of those things that exists because it's necessary. If you want to change something in the future, What you do is you worry about it, and then you can accelerate a computer terminal which will allow you the information to tell you whether or not the plane's going to crash. So you don't get on it if it's going to crash. You don't have any worries at all. I mean, if you worry has its own kind of inherent value. It keeps you from being neurotic. And on Earth, of course, worry is just another way of using up your present moments to be consumed about something in the future over which you have absolutely no control. So that's the first part of this book. Here's this wanderer arriving on this place, seeing all of these things, all these neurotic people, but having a reason for it all. Convinces Icus to come to Earth. All right? She arrives here, and it's like the middle third. This is very short. The middle third of it is her wandering around our planet, not being able to figure out why there's so many people here who are neurotic when they have no reason to be. Anxiety doesn't attack. Guilt doesn't change anything. You can't go into rewind while you're here. People have phobias because they choose to, yet they blame the snake. Or they blame the elevator. Or heights. They say, heights really scare me. Like, heights care? Heights don't care, folks. You're scared of heights because you choose to think that way when you get in high places, which isn't so bad. But don't blame the height unless you go to Uranus. On Uranus, mountaintops are on hinges, you see. That way, if you get too close to them, they kind of unhinge and scare the hell out of you. Oh, my God. But not on Earth. And, of course, the last third of it is like, here's a person who can only see reality as it is. And she's going to give advice to us, the secrets of the universe, if you will, on what can make our planet work at a whole new level. If we were only reality-based instead of non-reality-based, that is, the problem with being neurotic is not that you're unhappy. It's just that you're wrong. Yeah, neurotics are just wrong. They say, you're hurting my feelings. That's just wrong. You're embarrassing me now. Now you're making me feel bad. Nobody can do that. You know, nobody, as Eleanor Roosevelt told us, can make a fool out of you without your consent. Nobody can do that. Up to you. Now, I was going to call this book, and I had it all set. If you want to be happy, get your head out of Uranus. But I didn't. I called it Gifts from Icus, and I'm really excited about it. It's kind of a parable, satire, kind of a fun thing. Well, at the core of that book and that philosophy is one of the secrets of the universe. One of the secrets, and I say it as a secret simply because hardly anybody seems to understand it. So it must be a secret. And that secret is that you get treated in life the way you teach people to treat you. Period. And if you don't like the way you're being treated in your life, the thing to do is to look at how you have taught people to treat you. Learning that essential message in your life, that the basic things that make people neurotic are not so much the way the world is, but the way we look at the world. They see reality for what it is, they just don't want to accept it. They look at the world, they see it for what it is, and then they complain about it, and they wish that it were different. If only you were more like me, then I wouldn't have to be upset at you right now. If only you were something different than what you are, I could be happier in my life. If only oil prices hadn't gone up, if only unemployment weren't the way it is, if only, they look at the world and they're always looking to blame somebody else. And you can tell by the very vocabulary that they use, by the very words that come out of their mouths. They say things like, I'm having an anxiety attack. Don't bother me now, please. I can't, I'm having an anxiety. What is that? There's no anxiety in the world. And it sure as hell doesn't attack. Go out and let's get some anxiety, bring it back here and here, look at it, please. There's no anxiety in the world. There are only people thinking anxiously at any given minute in their lives. And the people who learn how not to think anxiously, regardless of the situation, no matter how terrible something may seem to you, The people who are able to do that in their daily lives, in everything, rising prices, taxes, unemployment, losing a job, your children disappointing you, somebody getting sick, someone close to you dying, someone flipping out and not doing things that you want them to do, all of the things that are what it means to be a human being, if you can learn how to handle those things, then when a crisis comes along, you have prepared yourself for being able to handle anything. If you are always shocked and taken back and finding yourself upset over things that happen in the world and wishing that it were different, these are the kind of people who become victims in virtually every situation. Another one of those secrets of the universe is that highly functioning people look for solutions, never for problems, always for solutions. I don't want to hear problems. How terrible it is. Isn't this awful? I want to hear, okay, these are the conditions. Let's see what can be done to make it work better. Solution-oriented people. Even when my daughter was down just recently in Florida and my nephews were down with me, and one of them would sleep on a mattress. And then at the end of the day, I said, Tom, you got to do something with that mattress. He said, well, hell, the best place is to throw it in Tracy's room. Worked for him, and he threw it in there Monday, threw it in there Tuesday, threw it in there Wednesday. Finally, my daughter had reached her level of tolerance and came out and wanted to talk about it. But she wanted to talk about why he had done that. And I said, honey, look for a solution. Don't look for a problem. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday are over. And you taught him. You taught him to throw it there by the fact that you put up with it. I said, what is it you want to say? She said, keep your mattress out of my room. He said, fine. You threw it in my room. And I threw him out. But once, I mean, it's like, that's the solution. It's over. We don't have to have a long discussion about it. We would like to know how to cope. Coping is wonderful. And I can remember people saying to me, especially when I was in school, because always throughout all my days in school, I was one of those, well, I call them scurvy elephants, as I talked about in Pulling Your Own Strings. Because when I came home from school one day and I asked my mother, I said, what is a scurvy elephant? She said, I don't know what a scurvy elephant is. I said, well, I heard the teacher saying that Wayne Dyer was a scurvy elephant in the classroom. So she got on the phone and she called. She said, no, I didn't say that at all. I said that he was a disturbing element in the classroom, you see. So I've always been that scurvy elephant, because there's a line from a wonderful E.E. Cummings poem.
He said, to be nobody but yourself in a world which is doing its best night and day to make you just like everybody else means to fight the greatest battle there is to fight and never stop fighting. And more than anything in the world, I think that that sums up what my beliefs are. Just to go out into the world, to be able to be the human being that you want to be, without any feelings of being manipulated by everybody else, or being a person who feels that they have to conform and fit in and do what everybody else thinks that they should be doing, is perhaps the greatest freedom you can have. There are a lot of people that think that freedom comes from being able to make a lot of money, being successful in whatever terms that may mean to you, or getting the adulation of all of your friends, or winning a football game or a tennis match. And that, in fact, means a person has achieved a degree of success. And it really hasn't. It doesn't mean that at all. The ultimate, the only real understanding of happiness is to understand that it is an inner concept. There's no happiness in the world. It doesn't exist. You can't get it. Never find it. You can search for it forever, and you'll never have it. Aristotle reminded us, wherever I go, there I am. You've always got yourself that you have to deal with, but to be able to be successful, to have happiness, and I think perhaps a lot of people believe that when my books came out, especially back in the mid-70s, in the last few years, that there's this whole element of selfishness in them,
that somehow I'm telling people that they ought to be selfish, which is the furthest thing in the world from anything that I believe, that I endorse, and certainly don't even know how to behave that way in my own life. I'm not a proponent of selfishness or abuse or using other people for your own ends. If they were, my book titles would have been, you know, How to Use Other People as Stepping Stones to Your Own Self-Actualization, or something to that effect. But that isn't what I believe at all. You see, to me, the greatest priority in life is the ability to enjoy it. Just to enjoy it. To be able to go through your life and enjoy your life. And people who know how to do that, how to take each day that they're alive and go through it and enjoy it, those human beings are never a burden to anybody else. And that is the least selfish thing that you can be in your life. You take people who know how to enjoy living, who know how to take any circumstance in their life and turn it into something positive. You take people who are never down and never a burden to anybody else, and you've got a human being who knows how to enjoy life. And when you get a person like that, you never find them abusing others or trying to sacrifice their life for other people or worrying what everybody else thinks about them or anything like that. It's a very important concept to get into your head, that when you get yourself to the point where you can take each day that you're alive and enjoy it, that you will never be anybody else's burden. You're never going to be anybody else's trouble. You won't even know how to be anybody else's trouble or burden. And then, when you are that shining light, when you are enjoying your life in those ways, what you do, even without even trying, is you're doing something unselfish. You're helping other people by setting your own example of what it means to be a fully functioning person, or whatever you want to call them. That living by example. That, did you ever notice how hard it is to argue with somebody who isn't neurotic? Ever notice that? Somebody who just doesn't want to be dragged down, somebody who doesn't want to be unhappy, somebody who doesn't want to be mad at the world. You ever notice how hard it is to get them into an argument? Yeah, sure, okay, yeah, you got a very good point. Wait there. I'll be back in a week. They're motivated by their needs for truth, for beauty, for morality, for individuality. And these are very important concepts to them. They are more responsive to beauty and understand it as a need. And you don't meet many of them like that. And you know, you can meet them in a Dairy Queen. You can meet them in a cab. You can meet them in a grocery store. They don't have to be philosophers. They don't have to be anybody who's achieved anything particularly special. But when you've been around them, you know it. I know it. I run into them because I look for them. And I interview them and I talk about them. Gail Sheehy's new book is called Pathfinders, and it's about, I haven't read it yet, but it's about uncommon people who find uncommon solutions to common problems. Pathfinders. Instead of following somebody else's path, they create their own. They have no elitism within them. They don't ever put themselves above anybody else or see themselves as better than any other human being. And the mysterious is attractive to them. Their ability to wander into the unknown, to try new things, rather than to stay with the familiar, is a pattern in these people. They don't want to do what's always been done, what everybody else has done. It's almost like if it's been done that way before, let's try it a different way. It's like doing it different just for the sake of doing it different. Beverly Sills is one of these people, in my opinion. I've met her, talked with her, been on her show a couple times in New York. She wears a bracelet, a charm bracelet, and on it she has the initials IDTA printed out. And I was talking with her, and I said, what does that stand for? She was going from being one of the great opera singers in the world to a new career. She was trying something else. She was going to be an administrator. She was going to take over the New York Metropolitan Opera. And they asked her, how could you do that? You're one of the greatest singers ever. You're at the peak of your career. Singing is like you're the best at it. She looked at the charm and she said, I did that already. Almost as if that was enough of a reason for her. She didn't have to prove it anymore. It's like doing something that you've done over and over again becomes drill. And drill is no way, in any way, shape, or form, a part of what No Limit people are like. They're unafraid people. They're people who are animal-like and have a great deal of love for everything that's alive. They have a fascination in the present moment. The now is what is for them. They're not obsessed with where they used to be and where they're going to be. So worry and guilt are not a part of their lives. How can I live more fully? Those are some of the qualities, how to achieve these qualities in yourself. And the answer, of course, is that you do it. And I've been putting down these notions, these secrets, and I want to share them with you. One of them that's so important was written by Voltaire. It was written in his wonderful book, Candide, where Candide left and traveled all around the world, went everywhere, and saw every kind of evil that you can conceivably come up against. You know, people who were murderers and killers and rapists and traveled everywhere. And the last line in Candide, if you haven't read it, take a look at it. He says, "I guess we'll have to learn to cultivate our own garden." I don't know. To me, that is like one of the most profound things ever written. And I think of it as a secret because hardly anybody can do it. You must learn to cultivate your own garden. You got to keep your nose out of everybody else's garden. If they want to grow rutabagas in it, that's really none of your business. If they want to use a different kind of fertilizer than you do, if they want to have weeds in it, as long as yours is the way you want it to be. Learn how to take what it is that you have and enjoy it and make your life work on your terms, cultivating for yourself a sense of purpose and a sense of mission for yourself. That's like one of the greatest secrets you can learn. Get your nose out of everybody else's garden and get your own in order. And stop focusing on everybody else's. Grow what you want to grow in your garden. Do it. One of the toughest things for people to understand is this little thing that I read in the Tantra, which is a Tibetan form of Buddhism, which teaches, as you go up the pyramid, of things to learn about how to survive and how to be your own person, how to be happy and so on. The top, the peak, is the one that hardly anybody understands, and it's the only one that really matters. And it goes like this: everything in the universe is exactly as it should be. Think of that. Whatever's out there is supposed to be there. And what's the evidence? It is. That's all. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't change things. Because if you can change things, then that should be. So let's, instead of getting mad at it, instead of blaming the mirror for what it reflects, instead of getting mad at the world the way it is, let's accept it and now do what we can to improve it. But you have to get your mind off of judgment in order to do that. Mind off of judgment. Walking down the street, an old person walking down the beach, looking at young people, whatever old and young mean to you. Look at those kids. They don't even wear any clothes when they go on the beach. They wear bikinis, like they toss themselves around. They're throwing frisbees on the beach. They got their dogs over there. All judgment. All looking at the world and saying, "I don't accept it for what it is. I want it to be different." And then the young people walking by and look at the old people. Look at those old wrinkles. They don't have any fun at all, and they're always mad at us. They don't wear anything modern. Instead of looking at the world as everything in the world is just exactly as it should be, instead we judge it. We judge it. We wish that it were different. We want it to be something other than it is. And until you can get off of judgment and understand that the truth as it exists out there, is the evidence for it is that it exists. So don't be judging it and looking at the world. You know, the question that the ancient Tantra philosophers used to ask is, do you see the world as it is or as you are? You know, if you see the world as you are, then you want it to be the way you think it should be. If you see the world as it is, then you can improve it, and never before. One of the great secrets was written by Nietzsche. He said, "This is my way." What is your way? The way doesn't exist. Think of that. There is no the way to do anything. There is my way. What's your way? The way doesn't exist. you open yourself up to, there is no necessarily right way to do it. And when you do that, you eliminate so much conflict, so much pain, so much bitterness. This is my way. What is your way? The way doesn't exist. My own development is probably just as appropriate to talk about here as anything on these tapes, because I often think to myself that if I can do it coming from where I came from, that anybody can. I come from impoverished beginnings, a child who never had an allowance in his life, didn't even know what it was. When other kids would talk about my allowance, I didn't know anything about that because there just wasn't anybody there to give me an allowance. The people that were there didn't have it to give away anyway. So it was very, very early in my own development that I learned the secrets of being my own person and my own strength. I can remember just as a young boy being in classrooms and having teachers yelling at us and trying to get all of us to feel guilty and feel upset and feel angry because as a class we were misbehaving in some way or another. And I can remember one teacher just screaming at us, "He's never had such a bad experience, and this is the worst class he's ever had." And I can remember sitting there thinking, "This is the worst that you've ever had? I mean, your life must be really easy if this is the worst you've ever had." And my friends would come up to me, and girls in the class and people, you know, that I knew that were in the class would all be all upset over what this teacher had said. And I can remember just as a young kid, I mean, we're talking about the first and second grade now, I can remember saying, "She's just doing that to control you. She's just doing that to get you, you know, you don't have to be upset. You don't have to be hurt. You don't have to be unhappy. You don't have to be angry. You don't have to be any of those things. That's just what she's using to try to get you to be what she thinks that you should be." And it works most of the time. And I can remember saying that to my friends, that somehow within me, when I showed up on this planet, I believed that I had a mission. I had something that a lot of my friends didn't have, and that was an inner knowingness that no one could decide what my emotions were going to be or what my life was going to be like or how I was going to feel about something. That internal kind of knowingness isn't something I believe that I learned somewhere along the line through some magical, instantaneous kind of revelation. It was something that I believe I showed up with here. And that I think that every single person has that capacity for it, but they don't seem to choose it. And it's like knowing that you have that inner strength and knowing that nobody else can make you unhappy and knowing that no circumstance out there is too big for you to handle and knowing that when you go off to sleep at night, no matter what has happened all day long, that you still only have yourself to live with and that that very private inner world wherein you talk to yourself, and we call this self-talk or whatever you want to call it. All of us do this all the time. We have these conversations with ourselves, which is really two people. We are having a conversation with ourselves. And we do this all the time. And what the quality of those conversations are, how you process the daily events of your life and all of the things that are happening to you, is really the secret source of enormous strength. And then as you get a little older, you begin to put a label on that. You begin to identify that in some way as something that is more than just an intuitive way of processing the world in a positive direction. It's more than that. You begin to realize that you're not alone. And a lot of people believe that they are alone in the world, that this inner world of thought, and this inner world of power and of inner conviction or whatever you want to call it, is something that you can rely on, but it's not just something that you're alone with. And as I got older and more experienced in it, I began to see that that I believe I have someone with me or guides with me or some kind of help available to me at all times. And it's just really a question of whether you decide to believe it or don't believe it. It isn't anything we can put to a double-blind study and have a scientist come up and say, no, this doesn't exist or that doesn't exist. It's just a knowing. And when you have that guide, and almost all of the great spiritual masters and the great religions and so on, when you begin to study them, as I have done in more recent years in my life and written books about them and produced tapes about them, you begin to discover that the greatest thinkers, the great contributors, all have this sort of inner knowing that they're not alone. that help is available to you. Help in the form of whatever you want to call it isn't even relevant. If you want to call it God, or you want to call it Buddha, or you want to call it Christ, or you want to call it spirituality or consciousness or whatever, it isn't the label that's important. It's the experience of it. And it's the knowing that it's there, and knowing that you can go there at any time. An hour ago, from right this minute that I'm talking right now, I was on an airplane flying into Chicago. So 40 minutes before landing at O'Hare, I just decided that I would go within. I would go inside and have this guide or this force or this knowingness, this inner spirituality. And you begin to really rely on this, you see. You begin to know that it's there and it never fails you. I went into what most people walking up and down the aisles would have thought of was a meditation. But actually, I was just visualizing and picturing and working out exactly what I was going to be doing here today. Not every word and every detail and without an outline or anything like that, but I was seeing it working out and seeing myself being able to be fluent and seeing myself talking, picturing the outcome that I wanted for today, picturing it, literally living it out in my mind or in thought before it actually is played out in form or in the physical world. That is the greatest source of comfort to me for anything that I do. Anything that I do in my life, it is the greatest source to know that I can go there and have a conversation with God or with whatever you want to call it, because I'm not trying to push any particular religious point of view on anyone. This is not what it's about for me. But you need some kind of name for this, like, constant companion that is there with you at all times. Once you get that, you have what some people call faith. But it goes way beyond just faith, because faith just requires you to just believe it because somebody else says it, or because somebody else dictates to it, or because it's a part of some prescribed theology, or it's a part of some prescription that has been laid upon you as a part of your birth. Maybe you were born into a Muslim family, or you were born into a Buddhist family, or into a Sri Lankan family, or whatever, and you were expected to sort of follow through. And you just develop faith based upon what the accident of your birth is. Nothing like that. Nothing like that. It's way beyond that kind of faith. It's the faith of knowing. It's the faith of having an understanding that the universe is perfect and that everything in it is happening for a reason and that there are no accidents in it. And that as you go into this magical place, you begin to discover this universe within yourself that is all-encompassing, and that allows you to create in your mind exactly the outcome that you want, and then you work from that outcome. And even as I'm sitting here right now talking in the studio, I can see myself back on the airplane an hour ago, and I can see myself now living out what it was that I was doing back there. Well, you know, in a sense, I'm doing this as a grown man, and as the father of seven children, and, you know, as a 50-year-old person, and so on. But what I'm able to do now, to consult within myself, and have that faith that I'm not alone, and that I can consult this and go there, is no different than what I was able to do when I was 3 and 4 and 5 years old, and 18 years old, and I could, at this moment, chronicle my entire lifetime, and see that I was able to, as a very young boy, play it out in my mind first, like while the teacher was talking and trying to manipulate us into behaving well through her being upset and crying or angry or whatever it was. I knew at the time in my mind exactly what was going on. And while I was not necessarily one of the renegades creating all of the problems for her, I also knew that I wasn't going to choose to be full of anguish and pain and hurt because of something that she was saying. I just wouldn't go there. In my mind, I wouldn't go there. And so I would play it out in my mind first, and then I would tell other people about it. It's really interesting. When I talk to great athletes or great performers at any level, almost all of them have this sort of secret knowing. And so there's this enormous knowingness of faith, which is much more than just a faith based upon something that's imposed upon you. It's having gone within, discovered that you have a guide with you at all times, discovering that within your mind when you want to use it in a positive and picturesque way, that is picturesque in the sense of being able to picture what it is that you want for yourself, once you go in there and discover this, then you start to apply it. And you start to apply it all over the place, in virtually all areas of your life, for the big meeting that you may be having, or for the sales conference, or for whatever it is that may be on the horizon for you. It becomes second nature after a while to play it all out in thought and to ask for guidance, not for special favors, not so that my team can win and your team will lose, nothing like that. Like even asking the question, what am I here for? Do I have a purpose? And in what sense is what I am doing or about to embark upon commensurate with that purpose? And this is a very troublesome area for a lot of people, because a lot of people, most people, believe in sort of the accidental notion of what they're here about. You know, it's like you're just sort of an accident of your parents, you know, dalliance 9 months before your birth. And so most people don't go within and really discover this in their lives because they don't think that the universe is on purpose. I read an interesting article this summer on the astronauts and their spiritual experiences of having gone into the universe outside of the Earth plane and looking back. And one of the astronauts was quoted as saying that when he looked back at the Earth, this blue, blue planet, like what our sky is what you see from out there, and you look then in one direction, you see Earth and this tiny, tiny little dot, this blue dot, and then you look out the other way and you see an infinite number of worlds, and you look all around you and you're surrounded by this infinity of this universe. He said, I realized that there's an intelligence to this system, that it is an intelligent system that is all absolutely, and it's like it happened for him in a moment, this instantaneous kind of realization that there's an intelligence to all of this, that the intelligence that is a part of the universe, or that is allows the universe to work, again, the label isn't important. He said it made him realize that it's all working absolutely perfectly and that it's all on purpose and that all of it has a purpose. Well, I have discovered that most people really don't believe they have a purpose, or they spend a big hunk of their life trying to discover their purpose, or they will find so many events transpiring in their life that seem to be inconsistent with any kind of grander purpose that it's impossible for them to accept that this is anything but just one grand accident. I know it's not an accident. And once you discover your purpose, and the way that you discover that, that's that secret source, so that's the secret force, if you will, that is within you at all times, this invisible, silent, empty space that is a part of every one of us, that is what allows us to be. A lot of people are looking for the how-tos. You know, how can I become a more spiritual person? Or how can I find my purpose? And they start with the way that they learn anything. Problem-solving logic. A plus B plus C plus D equals whatever it is, and you just go through the steps. It's not like that. When you consider that everything that you have done in your life has led you up until this moment that you have right now. And all of the things that you have assessed to be negative, all of the addictions perhaps that you've had, all of the problems you've had in your marriages, all the problems you've had with your children, all of the weight problems perhaps that you've had, all of the difficulties that have come your way, the financial concerns and the bankruptcies and all of the stuff that if you were to reach into your bag, you know, you could pull out this whole bag full of negative stuff. You get to a point that the Buddhists call Satori, S-A-T-O-R-I, Satori. It means instant enlightenment, instant enlightenment. And the Buddhists believe, by and large, that enlightenment is something that happens in instants. It happens in moments. It's like I've talked about at some of my other tapes about going through the gate. You know, it's like on one side of the gate is the path that is strewn with thorns, all right? And there's all of the stuff that I have just described. And then there's this gate ahead of you. And then on the other side of the gate is this garden. And there's this flowers, and it's just magnificent, and there's happiness, and there's bliss, and there's fulfillment, and there's all of this wonderful stuff on the other side. But you can't get through the gate. And then comes the moment in your life when you go through the gate. You just go through. You know, the thorns that were there don't matter anymore. The obstacles are no longer obstacles. It's just and it's like, boom, instantaneously, you are now on a different path altogether. I can tell you that for those of you who are struggling and trying to find a formula and trying to get it all into A, B, C, D, E, F, it isn't that way. First of all of the thorns and all of the obstacles that have been created in your life are there for a reason, even though that's a hard thing for us to accept. There's something to be learned from each one of those. And so instead of saying, how can I avoid these in the future, you reprocess your life in a different way and say, I created this for what reason? And I'm going through this because, and you fill in the blanks, or the lesson in this for me is, right, instead of why is this happening to me and isn't this awful and so on. And then Satori happens. And I mean, that was very revealing for me to read about this instant enlightenment, because every major change that I've made in my life, I mean, they don't seem like major big changes, but the changes that I've made happened in instants. I mean, just in seconds. Now, in the physical world of changes that I have made, I can remember when I first decided that I was going to start running and exercising and get myself in shape instead of being overweight and out of shape like I had been, in an instant. And it was a doctor at a hospital where I wasn't a patient. I was working there. I was training the staff in group therapy at North Shore Hospital on Long Island. And this doctor said one thing to me. He said, if you continue on the path that you're on, you're going to be a candidate for a heart attack in 5 years. He wasn't trying to be helpful to me. He wasn't anything. He just was making a statement. And that evening, I went out and I ran for the first time as an adult. And it's now almost 15 years later, and I haven't missed a day of running in 15 years. It was just like an instant kind of thing, and then it was like carrying through on that. And, I mean, that really flies in the face of a lot of the stuff that we hear all the time about you have to have a goal and you have to have a plan and you have to get it all figured out and you have to work step by step by step. I really think that enlightenment or discovering this inner source of strength is something that just happens in an instant whenever you're ready. So whoever you are, I mean, if you're smoking, if you're drinking excessively, if you've got addictive habits in your eating habits and so on, if you are behaving in ways with your children or with your wife or coworkers or whatever, and you think that it's just hopeless and that you can't change and that it's just too difficult to process and so on, I'm really saying to you that in an instant you can decide to radically alter your life. And it isn't like even a decision-making process. You're now ready. The same Buddhists say that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And whatever it is that you will need to be able to accomplish what it is that you're here for, what your purpose is, what you're about, is going to be instantaneously and readily and easily available to you the minute that you allow yourself to go through that gate. It's just there for you, and it's so easy. Now, the same thing is true of this business about going within and visualizing and picturing what it is that you want for yourself and so on. I mean, 15 years ago, I would have laughed at that idea of meditating on an airplane, you know, before visualizing something on an airplane before I was going to do it or anything like that. I didn't have the readiness level then, and apparently I had an awful lot of lessons to learn before I got to the point where I am today, where I know that I'm not alone. And you only discover that when you're ready to discover it. And once you have the readiness, you'll see changes taking place. A lot of those changes I outlined in the tape series that we call Transformation. You'll see it when you believe it. What the steps are and what the signs are of your transformation in your life. And once you start seeing those, you'll start seeing yourself behaving and doing things in a different way than you did before, and reacting and processing and all of that in a different way. Then it's like you walk through and you start seeing these sensational changes take place, and it's almost as if you're outside of yourself watching them take place. And it's like your body becomes this actor, just this sort of vehicle. And in your mind, where you do all of your living, you're going through just unprecedented gates. Now, most people don't experience this or don't use this untapped, phenomenal universe that is within them because they're not at the gate yet. I mean, it isn't anything to be upset about. It isn't anything to be berating yourself for. It's almost like you have to become kinder and gentler with yourself where you are right now and accept even that. And as you do less of the judgmental stuff towards yourself, you can almost see down the road or see into the future. As you're using your mind in new ways, you're creating a whole new universe within. And that whole new universe within is just the precursor to the universe of your physical world. And if you're not doing that, I recommend that you discover that inner secret and go within. And I can, you know, perhaps give some specifics on how to do that. But don't discount the whole powerful notion of Satori, of instant awakening. When I talk about instant awakening or Satori, I'm not talking about eliminating the powerful human will to change and choice making. For those who have real logical sort of left brain minds, the dilemma is always, if I'm acting out a script and the script has already been written and there's an intelligence about this and that everything happens for a reason, then I must not have a free will, and therefore I'll just sort of sit back and sit in a cave and allow the world to transpire and allow my life to take place, and I'm really not in charge of it. You know, that's the great dilemma that a lot of people face until they get to the point where they realize that both things are operating at the same time. And you have to live with that duality or that polarity of being in charge and not being in charge, of being doomed to make choices. You learn to live with that paradox. It's the reason for the smirk on the face of the Buddha. You know, it's the, when you get used to it and live with it, it becomes almost delicious and exciting to know that you are at the same moment acting out a much grander scheme, and at the very same moment you're making all the choices within it all at the same time. And you can fight with that one forever and not get any place with it. What I suggest is that you know that every step along the way that you're making, along the path, all the obstacles, all the things that you're going through at this moment, that what you do is you start to process them a little bit differently. And process them not in terms of why do I have to do this and why isn't my life working out or why are things so negative and so on, but process it a little differently in that. Why am I choosing this? Why am I participating in this now? What do I have to get out of this? What is the lesson in it for me? And as you do that, you find yourself moving more and more towards the gate. And then when you come up to the gate, you just sort of slam it shut behind you, and you never look back again. And that's when you know that you're not alone. That's when you know that for whatever help that you are looking for, or whatever guidance you're seeking, or whatever road you want to travel, that there's another world other than the world of the five senses. That the five sensory beings, if you will, are the ones who just only believe in what they see and believe that the senses are the limitations of their universe. And those are the same people who, before the invention of the microscope, would have laughed and scoffed at the existence of microscopic life. And then there's the multisensory beings, or the beings who believe in things that are invisible, like myself, who don't need to have a measuring device to know that it exists. Because you can't measure your thoughts, and you can't measure spirit, and you can't measure consciousness, and you can't measure soul. These are just sort of abstractions. But we all know that we think and that we have thoughts. the multisensory person is someone who absolutely and completely knows that there's guidance and help there, whereas the five-sensory being says, no, the limits of your help are just exactly what you can do with your hands and with your eyes and with your ears and so on. And I happen to be one of those multisensory beings who doesn't need a measuring device, even though I believe one will be forthcoming in years to come, to prove the existence of the soul or to prove the existence of divine intervention or divineness as a part of your humanity. I know it. It works for me. I go there all the time. Those people who don't ever experience that in their life are just not experiencing it because they choose to only restrict themselves to whatever they can experience with their five senses. Anything else just doesn't make any sense. Yeah, there are people who seem to be cursed with an awful lot of bad luck, what we call bad luck, whose relationships don't work, who have financial problems, who perhaps are restricted in wheelchairs or physically in some way incapacitated. And tragedy seems to be on every doorstep of their life. And yet it's amazing that when you meet people who have had these kinds of conditions, how some people who've gone through those horrible conditions will curse it and be angry with it. And so their life, their where they do all of their living, which is again is in the mind, is filled with despair. And there are others, I mean, you just have to watch the Jerry Lewis telethon to see young people who've been racked with muscular dystrophy come up on stage and be the most positive and joyful and beautiful people. And you wonder, how can somebody who is trapped in such a prison of a body that doesn't work in any level have such a magnificent attitude in their life, when you would think that they would have every reason in the world to be negative? It always depends upon what that inner soul is like. If you're going through tragedy after tragedy and difficulty after difficulty, and those things continue to multiply, you might just start asking yourself, am I playing any role in this? No blame, no, it has nothing to do with that. It's like, what's in this for me? And why am I going through this life this way? And you begin to see that as you change inwardly and begin to realize that you're part of the perfection of it all, and that God is with you regardless of what the physical world for you is like, and that this isn't your humanity, that you're not a human being having a spiritual experience, you're a spiritual being having a human experience, and that human experience that you're having right now is a part of what you're here for, what you sort of signed up for. And if you can get past the poor me, this shouldn't be happening, isn't this awful mentality of all of that, you can transcend it. And if you can't, you know, it's really like which comes first. It's a chicken and the egg kind of question that we're discussing here. Is the negativity in my life the result of my thinking, or is my thinking creating this negativity in my life? You have to always ask yourself over and over again. It's like no matter how terrible the circumstances of your life, is being upset, miserable, full of despair, anger, hatred, and all of that kind of negativity, is that going to do anything to correct that? And even the person who seems to be in the worst of circumstances, who doesn't have the attitude of this shouldn't be happening to me, but instead is saying it is and what's in it for me, you'll find that that person will not be living inwardly in that divine inner universe that is who you are, in agony and despair. That isn't what their life is about. Externally, it may look that way. Externally, there may not be enough food on the table. Externally, they may be being beaten up by somebody. And externally, they may be in bankruptcy and all of that. But inwardly, where you do all of your living, that isn't how they process it. You know, it's like that's the kingdom of heaven. It's within. You've got to look at almost the duality of what it means to be human to understand this. One of the things it means to be human is to be in a physical body and all of the physical things that happen to us. And so many of the programs that are put out and the emphasis is on how to make that physical body more attractive and how to keep it young and how to keep it rich and how to keep it insured and how to make a lot of money for it. And that's one big focus, all right? And certainly there's nothing wrong with any of that. But then there's another major part of being human That is the inner universe, the universe within you. And in that inner universe, the outcomes and the goals and the processes are completely the opposite. They're very, very different. You can't smell inner awareness. You can't touch it. You can't feel it. You can't get a hold of it. You can't dissect it. You can't put it into a measuring device. It is yours to have as a divine package, or it's yours to have as a corrupt and awful package. It just depends on how you use that inner world. And the irony is that as that inner world becomes filled with harmony and love and caring and acceptance for yourself first and then for others, as you extend that outwardly, and as that begins to happen for you, the physical world, the other part of you, where you're trapped in this physicalness, also begins to get all the things that you were so determined to get for you. It all seems to work together.